Welcome to the Shofar Stellenbosch Sermon Series. We hope that you will be blessed by this message. Our sermons are also available on Shofar TV. Go to www.shofaronline.tv to download and share.
Good evening. Good evening. You can't sleep yet. I'm delighted to be here. I wondered, you know, what have I done that I have not been invited back? Last time I was here, I think it was 3-4 years ago, and I'm hoping to do better tonight so that I can be invited again. But thank you so much for having me. What a joy, what a pleasure. You know, something just jumped in me when I saw the hands of the younger generation that put up the hand. And when I got in here, the pastor asked me, please, will you share part of your testimony? And then I said, what time tomorrow morning you want to finish? But I sat there and I felt it good to do so and perhaps do my prepared sermon a bit shorter, and maybe I can be invited back to come and finish it. And share, I just feel that, you know, it's the right moment, it's the right time. I don't do it very often, but the fact that I'm asked and I feel in my spirit it's the right thing to do. I'm going to do a little bit of it if I'm not going to keep you here for a few days. My name is Chris, and I am the proud father of 4 children. Last time I remember it was 8 grandchildren and 3 great-grandchildren. I was married to the love of my life for 52 years. And then she swapped me for heaven. Was a good swap for her, not for me. And I thank God every single day for the joy and the pleasure that I've had in marriage and the family that God has blessed us with. We have ceased being a family. We are now a tribe. So if you read any signs about the tribe of Lodewijk, that's my tribe. I think the last time I counted, we sit around the table about 25, 26 of us when they all come. Any excuse for a party, because they're all over the world and they're very busy. But when we get together, there is a party. Be sure of that. And, you know, maybe when I finish telling the part of my testimony, you'll understand why I say that when I look at them sitting there and I see them, I smile, I laugh, I cry. And I see them there sitting. God has blessed all of them serving the Lord, every single one. And I see them there and I look at the one and I see there is an Aussie. And I look at the other one, I say, there's a Thai. And I look at the other one, I say, oh, there is a British. I look at the other one, I say, there's a Van der Merwe, Afrikaner. And I say, there is a South Sotho. And I can go on. I got the United Nations right there in the family. And wow, what a joy, what a privilege. To see them and to be part of a family that makes my life so easy and make it a joy to be a dad. My wife enjoyed it too until she passed on 4 years ago, and I'm still learning to live alone. It's very difficult. I put 3 ads in the paper. Nobody applied. So, no, not true. No. But I've had 52 wonderful years of marriage, and I just thank God for that. Now, if I'm going to spend a few minutes, and it's difficult to do in a few minutes, but I'm going to just cut and paste here and there. About 1938, my mother gave birth to her second child. It was a boy. His name was Chris. And in a beautiful area of Cape Town, under the Constantia Mountains, place called just under the mountains as you come down towards Heathfield and those areas. And we lived there. Went to my first school there. And I remember the day my dad came back from the army when the war was on. And he came home, and he came home with his reward for being in the army and fighting there. And he got a bicycle. And I saw him very angry. And the next day he went out and he went to go and sell the bicycle. I don't know for what, just give it away. And I'm listening to him and my mom, and his mom says, "Where is the bicycle?" And he says, "I gave it away. I don't want to see it." I thought, "What's wrong with the bicycle?" He says, "Well, we came back from the war, black and white, and me, the black, I got a bicycle, and the white got a farm." And I listened to it because I'm only about like 5, 6, 7 around there. And for the first time, I tasted animosity. For the first time. I didn't know what it meant or what it is. I never knew the word. But I sensed something that was unfair, you know. And anyway, I grew up and carried on, and it didn't hinder me much. Until a few years later, then, my mom and dad had a big problem because slowly but surely, the Group Areas Act was beginning. The act was not there yet, but they were already preparing for it. And there we are in Meadow Ridge at the foot of the Constantia Mountains, and we got to be out. And I remember asking, but I got no answer because, you know, children don't ask questions those years. You just, you know, behave yourself and see what's happening. But so because my mom was white and my father colored, their marriage was soon to be null and void. But before that, we had the problem that we now wouldn't know where we are going to stay because there is no alternative housing, because we got to move and get out of the place that was soon to be declared a place for white people. When I saw that we had to move and leave, and I remember us as a family, we were 5 children by then. At that time, you normally had more children because there was no TV those years. So, we are summoned to leave, and as soon as you can, because will be rezoned, and we have nowhere to go. I think we were on the road for about, I think, more than a half a night, almost a day and night, and nowhere to go, looking for a house for our mom and dad and 5 children. And there were some Muslim people down the street in Deep River, not too far from where Retreat is and or Heathfield is. And they said to us, "Well, you know, we haven't got place, but what we do have is we have a stable. If we don't mind, we will let the horses out if you with your 5 children can go and stay in the stable." Of course, we were, not happy, but thankful. And there we are. We got into the stable. The family of us, just not a big stable, for about 2 or 3 horses, but we all got in there. We were more than the horses. And And that's where things began to really happen to me. I must say that I thank God because I have something in common with Jesus. We both lived in a stable. But I knew something is not right because now I'm a bit older and we have this problem and I see the agony and the pain of my mom and dad. Soon after that, we're just in the stable and then comes the Mixed Marriages Act is beginning to come up. And I saw the pain of my mom and dad, that they now are illegal. My mom, for almost 2 years, fought and struggled to be reclassified downward to colored so that we can be as a family together. Starting from right there where my dad went to go and sell the bicycle to coming through, moved out of the house, and then live in the stable to now see my mom struggling to keep a family together. Those things made me somebody extremely bitter. I was angry. I was bitter. He tells me I still got another 2 hours. I sensed something that was ugly, really ugly. And eventually, as we went on, I got more bitter than anything else. I literally hated every single white person that I see anywhere because of what has happened to my family, the way we were torn apart. At the age of 14, I was thrown out of school for bunking school. Can't afford the things that are needed in the school. I go find my first job at the age of 14. I have no future. I go start in the public gardens in Cape Town. And I go work there as almost a nobody. But I was determined to work my way to become something, even with this anger that I have in my... I was more wanting to show to myself, you're not that bad. And I worked myself to the highest rank that I could in the horticulture. And when I was finished there, I sought another way and I worked into the building of the tanker basins in the harbor and assisting there. And I went from one job to another, not every single day, but working myself to the top. And when I got to the ceiling, I go look for another one because I have no education and now I got to find a way to have a decent life. Well, cut it short because that board is going to be shown to me every time. I ended up being, how many of you know WJM Construction? A few of you only, and there are very young people here. WJM Construction is one of the biggest civil engineering constructions here. I ended up being the manager of WJM Construction. During all of that time, I studied, I worked. I have in that stable when I was 14 accepted Jesus. I accepted Jesus, it went in a month. I preached my first sermon at the Woodstock Town Hall in Cape Town for 1,000 young people. Please don't try and get the tape. I don't know what I said. I have no idea. I was a Christian a month. Why they would do that to me? It's cruel. You don't even do that to an animal. But I preached. Somehow young people came to the Lord. And I'm so thankful for that. But that was the first. Now, by the grace of God, some 63 years later, I'm still preaching. And I'm a better person. And I cannot go without telling you how I have, after accepting Jesus and being a bitter young man, hating every single white person on earth, Why would you allow me to preach here tonight if something did not happen? I was very involved in planning of events and conferences, especially up in Johannesburg. Later had the Harmony 19s, the Harmony Safaris, and you may read it in the history. Organized that at Ellis Park and at the Wanderers Stadium and all. And there was one of it called the Renewal Conference, and there were about two, three of them held in South Africa, one after another, two, three, every 2 years. And I was one of the planners of the Spiritual Renewal Conferences with speakers from all over the globe. And I felt so good about being involved in these events, and that event made me so, so happy. 6,000 people packed into that stadium at the showgrounds. And there we were, and what a beautiful evening. Remember, we're still in apartheid. And at that place, I saw a picture that I've never seen in my life. We all together there, red, yellow, black, and white, no matter what, having a wonderful time with the outpouring of God's Holy Spirit. And when I saw that, I just thanked God, and I felt He should thank me. After all, I was the organizer. What would He do without me? I was putting this together. And I went up onto one of the higher platforms that circled the auditorium. And I went to go and stand up there. And I looked and I just smiled at myself. If I had a mirror, I would have taken a photo. Feeling so proud of myself, of what I have achieved. Almost forgetting everybody else at work. And when I saw what was happening, that people were running to one another, hugging one another, grabbing one another, crying on one another's shoulder, I stood there smiling and I said, "Oh Lord, thank you so much for this happening here. How wonderful this is." And I rejoiced there. And then I heard a voice that said to me, "What about you?" And I looked. And there was nobody. And I realized it was the Lord. And I said, "Lord, what about me? Don't you recognize me? I mean, I put this together. You know, all of this is sort of my, it's my thing, this." I heard it probably about 5-6 times. "What about you?" Eventually, I surrendered. And I said, "Lord, what do you want me to do? I've done all this and I feel good about what I'm doing, working for you." And the voice said, "What about you?" Eventually, I broke down and I said, "Lord, what do you want me to do?" And He said, "I want you to go ask for forgiveness." I said, "No. No, 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 no. No, you must speak to the perpetrator. I'm the victim." And there was a discussion between the Lord and I. I felt I ranked so highly in His, you know, in His thinking. I thought He thought something of me, and now He wants to humiliate me and said, "Go ask for forgiveness." We had a fight again, the Holy Spirit and I, and eventually I said, "Okay, Lord, okay, I'll do it. I will ask for forgiveness. Anybody you send to me, I will treat nicely. And I'll say, I'm sorry." And the Holy Spirit said to me, "No, you will go." And I'm up there. "You will go and ask for forgiveness." I said, "Lord, it can't be. Can't we make a deal? If they come to me, I will not treat them nastily. I'll be nice." I've never had such a long conversation with the Lord. And I'm the one that's, you know, feeling it all over. And He must be smiling as I'm beginning to break up. And then I surrendered again. It's always me that has to give in. And I said, "Okay, Lord, I'll go." And then I saw a man with his back to me, white hair. at quite a distance, and I said, oh, well, he's an old man. You won't give me a tough time. I'll go over and go ask him for forgiveness. And I walked down there, and when I touched him on the shoulder and he turned his head, I said, no, Lord, no. No, Lord, no. You cannot ask this of me. Not him, Lord, not him. The man was Dr. F.P. Moller, the head of the colored church, of the white church. And I was at that time the head of the colored church. I said, no, Lord, you can't do that to me. But I once again had to give in. And I went down there. I tapped him on the shoulder and he turned around. And I said, Doc. And he says, hello, Pastor Chris, how are you? I said, I've come to ask you for forgiveness. And he said, no, it is I that must ask for forgiveness. And we had a fight again. Just like in the boardrooms where we fought every time we got in there because of the apartheid in the church. Here I'm coming to ask for forgiveness and we have a fight again. He says, it's I that must ask for forgiveness. I say, no, I must ask for forgiveness. And Doc Moller, very, very conservative Afrikaner. You don't hug him. I've never seen him hug a person. He hugged me. I hugged him. And we cried on one another's shoulder. And I felt something happen. Something very special happening right there. As we both sobbed and cried. And that theologian doesn't cry. That night, we both cried on one another's shoulder. And then I said, Lord, this must be it. They call it love. And the Lord said to me, can you take this guy out somewhere else? No, I'm only joking. They were just ready to take him out now. Yeah? Sorry, it's okay. Listen, I'm at the serious part now, eh? Don't laugh. I said, Lord, I feel something that I've never felt in my life. And I said, Lord, is this what they call love? And he said, not yet. And I said, what can be more than this? And this is not a story I read. This is the truth. If ever I heard the Lord, I heard it there. And the results is proof of it. I turned around and I found myself leaving the stadium, the interior of the stadium, leaving out as if I'm going home. And it's still sort of finishing up. I walked out not knowing where I'm walking to. And as I walked out outside within that big area outside, I went to go and stand opposite on the pavement. And when I stood opposite the pavement, I stood there wondering, why am I here? What am I doing? And as I was standing, the big gates of the big place opened up, metal. And I could hear the cracks and as they people started coming out. And when they came out, I heard the voice of the Lord. And it said to me, ain't they beautiful? And I looked as they came out. And I said, yes, Lord, they beautiful. They beautiful. I heard it for a second time. Ain't they beautiful? I said, yes, Lord, they beautiful. And then I heard the voice of the Lord for a third time. He said, even the whites, ain't they beautiful? And my face changed. And I said, yes, Lord, even the whites, they're beautiful. And I felt something happening, something deeper than what happened inside the auditorium. I felt peace come into my heart. And I said, Lord, this must be it. I feel love coming into my heart. And I heard the Holy Spirit said, not yet. And I thought, what more can I do? Suddenly, I was attracted by a truck coming down towards the people at high speed. and I saw something that was about to happen that will kill many people. I saw that truck coming down at high speed. And when I saw it and I looked at the people and the truck, I didn't know what to do, and I showed my hands, and then I ran across and stood between the people and the truck. And when I looked, there was no truck. And I turned, felt very, very, I apologized, and I walked back. And the Holy Spirit said to me, "That's love. If you're prepared to give your life for others." That was my second birth. And I thank God for that. Because if I had the time to tell you what He prepared me for through all of that, I don't have the time. But I can tell you, I found peace. I went to go and ask wherever there was a person that I knew that I dislike or hate. I went to go and ask for forgiveness. I live in peace with all people. I have found what it is to love even people that I absolutely dislike and despise. It was that I feel that made me just in a way qualify to be an agent of change, because God can't change something or somebody through you unless you are changed. I've had the awesome privilege to, from the first day of the negotiations at the World Trade Center, to be there. I saw political parties come in there, leaders that did not know one another. I don't know where they all came from. I never knew there were so many political parties. But the bitterness and the animosity, you could cut with a knife in there. Absolute enemies. Absolute enemies. And yet, it didn't need a full year of the first year before seeing so many of them playing snooker when they're in the evenings when they are free. To see, here is, the deputy president now, he's there. And here is Ruth Meyer from the National Party. And here is the deputy president, what's his surname? Namaphosa Cyril. Both their enemies. Not wanting to almost look at one another, but within a few months playing pool together. I saw miracle after miracle after miracle. And you know what? I came to believe that Jesus is everything that He says He is. Everything. There's nothing that He says about Himself that I don't wholly believe, because my eyes have seen it. And then I had the privilege of being involved here, and I want to tell you one story about South Africa, what had happened there that you may not know. But I can tell you stories of after South Africa, when it was finished here, there were calls on us working in Northern Ireland for unification, for peace there, working in Australia on the Aborigine problems that's still there, and eventually the TRC in Rwanda to bring people together there. And just to tell you that even if I'm a little bit older than I was, I leave on Friday for Seychelles, where a new government has been instated. And next week I will address the Parliament of Seychelles, also with them preparing to bring peace to their nation. Pray for me. That's the only reason I'm saying it. God had to grant and forgive and give me peace before I can be a peacemaker. I want to tell you just one story, and I'm watching that numbers there. I'm probably only going to preach for 5 minutes. But let me say this to you. There was a time, and I want to tell you two little stories. No, three. No, four. No, just two. Just two. But we had just sort of more or less finished. But there's still a lot of negotiations. And you will remember when there was a tit-for-tat thing. Those of you who can remember, you know, in Kenilworth, the church was bombed there and a lot of people died in that attack there, and it's mostly the APLA forces that did it. And it was tit-for-tat. It's then the South African government, then the guys from outside. And one night I was doing, in preparation for the election in Mthatha, and just having the church leaders from all over Mthatha there, sharing with them as to how the election is going to go. And that evening, I went to go and stay the evening with a guy who is now in his London, a pastor. And many of you would know him, Gradwell. And stayed at his house. And the next morning, there on television was a scene that only about maybe not even a kilometer from where I was speaking there, something happened during the night, about 2 hours after our meeting, that a South African army got in there because they had the intelligence that there were some of the APLA forces there planning. They went in there and shot that house with literally thousands, thousands upon thousands of bullets to make sure that nothing in there lives, because it was supposedly to be the APLA commanders. I said to Marius Gradwell, please, will you take me there? He said, yes. When I got there, or we got there, the mothers of four children who were in there studying for their exams, who was killed, stood outside, all their furniture shot to smithereens. The house, you wonder how it's standing with all the bullets that's gone through there. I asked them to go inside, and I said to them, please, will you go inside? Will you allow me to pray for you? Prayed for them, give them a bit of cash to try and start up. And when I was finished, I made a few phone calls, and I said, this now calls for another attack again from the other side. So I phoned the secretary of the APLA commander force. I phoned him and I said, we got to talk. We got to talk that you don't take action. He said, Pastor, you know it doesn't work like that. I said, it must work like that for now. Anyway, we had an argument for an hour, and then eventually I said, we want you in the church on Monday morning or Tuesday morning, I can't remember, all of you, your whole PAC members, not members, but the leaders must be there. They said, we can't do it. And anyway, after a long argument, the next morning, there they were in the church, sitting on the other side of the desk as we spoke to them. We asked them to not seek revenge. They said, no, please, don't talk like that. It doesn't work like that. They said, we're canceling everything else that we were planning to do. Also, our talks with the South African government ministers in Harare, we're canceling that. Well, a prayer meeting, and 3 hours later, they said, okay, we won't attack, and we will honor that meeting in Harare, but on the condition that you go with us. Ron Steele and myself had to clean our desk quickly, and we hurried there the next week. And there were 38 commanders that were fighting from the outside during our war times that we're trying to bring into the talks. They were there with their leader, Sabila Palmer. And as we got there, the ministers from the South African government came along, and they were going to have talks. They managed to stay all day in the place without anybody walking out. They came out, and we said, how did it go? We talked. I said, what did you talk about? We talked about talks. And they were there the next day, and they said, what happened? How is it going? No, we're going okay. We talked. What did you talk about? We talked about more talks. That's what some politicians do, you know. They talk about talks. So third day finish, and I said, Ron, now we can head home. And this is what I want to place with you. Before we could leave for home. Sir Bill Palmer, the chief commander of the Upper Forces, slapped me on the back, on the shoulder. A heavy slap, man. I said, yeah, where's this terrorist taking me now? And he took us into a room, Ron and I, and he said to me, he said, Reverend, talk to us. And there sat the other 38 commanders around the wall. And I thought, you had talks, a lot of talks about talks. And he says, now talk to us. And I got the message that he's saying to us, you know, talk to us as a Christian, as he said, as a reverend. And I chatted to them for 35 minutes about the need to lay down arms, about the need to come back, so having spent all your years outside in fighting, in enmity, come back home, come and repair, come and do something. After the 35, 40 minutes that I shared that I said, but you would know as well as I do that you're not in a position to do it by yourself. You are commanders, and I tell you, unless you meet the upper commander, my commander, that changes lives, you will not be able to do it. I want you to come back, live in peace, help change our nation. You know, when I gave the altar call, and without speaking evangelistically, at least 35 of the 48 were down there with tears that have come in and gave their lives to the Lord. And you say to me, well, how far did it go? I can tell you, I met some of them later when we were at peace. I can tell you stories like that of what God has done in this nation. And that's why I believe, as ugly and as terrible as some may seem it today, I say to you, God would not have done what he did that time to just drop us here. He's going to take us all the way. And I thank God for that. He's able to do that. And it's these kinds of things that happened not only to me, but to many of the others that were in the team working. That he's picking up the wrong boards every time he gives me more time. And I firmly believe that what God has set up there, because our change in our nation was an absolute miracle. I promise you, South Africa would have made, any of these countries that had wars and so, would have made them look like a tea party compared to what would have happened in this nation. God, using a wonderful man such as Nelson Mandela and others, and intervening. I don't think you know how many prayer meetings there were. I don't think you know that behind the chamber where all the meetings were happening of those 4 or 5 years, right behind there was set up. We set up a prayer chamber there, and there were day and night prayers. And every time somebody walked out, he doesn't want to go on with the talks, we go fetch him, we bring him in there, and lay hands on him and pray. And God was in this. Do you think he'll bring us through all of that and then drop us here? Never. Never. That beautiful day, that absolutely beautiful day when we stood. I love that picture, you know, that snake through the grass all over, people going to vote for the first time in their life. What was it? Yesterday, it was 23 years ago. The maid and the madam and the madam together there for the first time, standing in line and not standing in separate lines together. They're going to vote for the first time in their life. I have an apology to make. I did vote illegally, but the Lord has forgiven me already. I was one of the inspectors that had to go through the booths and so, where they were having it in the buildings and in the churches and so. And I inspected the one, and after I inspected the one, I saw it was 7:05, and I said to the chief in charge, I said, man, I might as well vote. And I said, no, Reverend, you can't. We must only open strictly by law 7:00. I said, man, what does 5 minutes? See, it's already 4 minutes, you know. By the time I voted, it was 7:03. It's illegal, but the Lord has forgiven me. I stood there making my mark, feeling angry that I was in the 50s to now for the first time vote in the country of my birth. And yet excited and joyful that it happened in my life and my children won't go through what I go through. And God helped us. And then came the election, 2-3 days, it went everything, and then started something again. And you wouldn't know that it wasn't in the newspapers. I was so happy it was over because we worked. We were three of us that were leading the teams, working. And the one was Peter, he's the Methodist bishop of Johannesburg, now lives in Fishhook, where he's retired. I wish I can. And then we had another of the Anglican bishop, and the three of us were the guys that were really behind the scenes putting things together. And I went home that night, and it was past 12, and I got home, and my dear wife that have, you know, special wife to be put up with me, my. And then she says, how did it go? And I explained to her all, everything, you know, how wonderful it was, and so, you know, and after hour 2 hours telling her all the stories, and so, you know, she's also voted early in the morning. I said, we better go sleep now because it's almost 3:00 in the morning. So we went to bed, and a half an hour later, the phone rings. And when the phone rings, the Methodist bishop is on the phone. He says, Chris, we got a problem. I said, what? The election is over. He says, Chris, do you remember about a year and a half ago, 2 million voting ballots in Pretoria that were stored there disappeared? It was stolen out of Pretoria's Waterkloof Air Base that we thought it's the safest place to put that. Do you remember it was never found? We had to print more. I said, so what? He says that the Electoral Commission has now decided that those ballots could come in when the counting starts within 2 days. And that will make the whole of the election null and void. I said, why are you phoning me? He says, Chris, you must recruit, you must train, and you must deploy 1,400 men across the country. I said, how can you ask me that? He says, well, you know, it's just that somebody's got to do it. I said, why? And my name is Chris, not somebody. And the three of us worked 4 days, 2 days later, before they started counting, we had 1,400 leaders, mostly pastors from across the country, all over the country. We commandeered aircraft and everything must stand still. We won those people within a day after we trained them the one day in the places. Nobody knew why they're in there. They're just there to watch and make sure that those ballots does not come in. Well, God was good. I tell you, He brought us through. 3 days later, we sat in the hotel near the airport with the United Nations Supervision Force. And when the leader got up, we sat around the table, probably about 40 of us, and he said, I have overseen elections all over the world. I have never seen anything like this. This must be a miracle, and Bishop Tutu said, yes, it's a God-given miracle. They recognized it was an absolute miracle. And together with the United Nations and that body of people of us that were sitting there, the what is their names? It's a very long name that they were given, but they were the people together that on the side of religion and church and everybody in the public area would declare the election free and fair. I can go on telling you stories of miracles. We didn't come here by accident. We didn't come here on a, you know, high speed, coming here, free flow, no problems. We came here through thick and thin, through heavy, heavy, heavy problems. I'm saying this to you, and I've agreed to speak more on the testimony of what God has done. And I can go on for hours telling you how God has brought us through. Because you know that the genocide in Rwanda happened almost just weeks after Mandela was installed. And immediately he phoned. And he sent us for South Africa to go and do his first ever in South Africa to go to the rescue of another nation. And he says, I'm giving you transport, aeroplanes, whatever you need, collect the food stuff and everything for the people that are still alive in Rwanda. I've never felt so powerful in my life, commandeering army trucks and aeroplanes. And we took 18 giant plane loads for the first time South Africa went to the aid of another nation. Just a young nation. And God helped us to be of help to another nation. Let me say this to you. When God saved you, yes, he loved you. But when he saved you, he really had others in mind. He really had others in mind. All of us are not here only for our gratification, not only for what we get out of life. We want the best, yes. But we are here because of others. And God has used this nation. There are still now a lot of our people across the world being of assistance to others, although they more need it now with the problems we have. But be that as it may, God has helped us and brought us through. You know what is my greatest pride and joy? I remember that I said to you, I come out of a stable. What I have in common with Jesus. Every time God has done something that makes me feel good, you know, that I feel before I can ever even try to be proud, I remember the stable boy. The 14-year-old stable boy. And I will always be, every time God picks me up one step, I will take two steps down. Because I'm the stable boy that he took. Yes, I had to work hard for the years in education that the locust has stolen from me. And instead, I didn't mind that. Today, I am privileged to have served the Lord out of South Africa in 143 countries of the world. And what a privilege. And if I do that, every time there's the slightest little, hi Chris, nice work, I think of the stable boy. I've been privileged to receive 10 different awards in the world, sitting with 11 presidents in discussions across the world. Every time I come out, I sob and cry, and I say, Lord, you took the stable boy to do this. I'm saying this not to talk about myself. I'm saying this to you to give testimony and say to you, God wants to use each one of us for much more than we think of ourselves. We don't even have to dig very deep to find what it is. Now, before I see now that I got another few minutes. But I don't want you to leave on a sad face. So I'm just going to give you 10 minutes of my almost hour-long sermon that I was going to preach to you. You know, I was going to speak to you about the power of joy. And, you know, I'm a joyful guy. You, if, you know, I mean, my dear wife, because I always confessed it, that I'm a person full of joy, the joy of the Lord, man, it means a lot to me. And every time I pull my face for something, she says, "My husband, you are sad." I said, "No, I'm not sad." She says, "Yes, your face says you're sad." Because I'm always a joyful person. And I want to speak to you about the power of joy. I haven't got the time to do it. But I want to say to you that, you know, I have a favorite pastime. And you may have a different one, but I have a favorite pastime. Many places in the world, when I'm finished with what I need to do, I walk up to a garden or sit by a lake or something, and I go sit there and I watch people. My favorite pastime, watching people. So if you have walked by where I was sitting, I watched you. I have this kind of thing, this passion to watch people. I dearly love people. But I watch them. I watch their faces. I watch to see how many are sad. I watch to see how many are happy. I watch people. I want to see. It's almost as when I see their face, I see right inside them. And I don't know where I get it from, but it's been with me for years. I'm glad I looked at Mary and saw her. And she became mine. I look at people. And you know, I have noticed over the last 5 to 10 years that people's smiles in many ways have disappeared. We are part of a world that have lost their joy. Because of what is happening all around us, people are losing their joy. And it's not supposed to be. It's such a valuable, valuable part of being a Christian. The devil robs it and destroys us because we think of the problems we have, because there's always problems. Yeah, always problems. 40% of the things we worry about never happen. 30% of our worries are related to past matters which you can now do nothing about. 12% of our worries have to do with our health, even when actually very healthy. 10% of our worries are about friends and neighbors and are not based on evidence and facts. But we worry. We've just moved into a neighborhood now in a place called, I'm still learning to know the name of the place. But it's Barbecue Dunes and near Kyalami. And we moved in there and 3 houses in front of us. And I look for any opportunity to, as quick on the day that I move in, you know, greet and say, "Hi, how are you? My name is Chris. How are you doing?" And the 3 of them are just wonderful. And the one on this side, you know, anything you need, just talk to me. And on now this side, it's a couple that when they see us, they don't want to make friends or so. We're only there 2 weeks and I'm not giving up on them. But some people somehow just feel that they want to live with a kind of a sadness. I don't know if it helps them or so. I don't think so. Do you know that only 8% of our worries have some basis of reality? Which means that over 90% of the things we worry about never happened. And we worry. And we worry. And because of that, we lose our joy. We lose our joy. Our present environment have been robbed. And we allow ourselves to be robbed of the joy that Christ intends for us. 166 times the Bible talks to us about the value of joy. And another 35 times it speaks about joyousness and joyfulness and so. But that's something like over 200 times. If God did not want us to live in joy, He would not add it and make sure that we read it almost all over. I was going to speak to you about Nehemiah. Man of a luxury life that he had, you know. Had a lovely life. He almost had to always smile, because if he did not, he'll be killed by the king. And later, he comes away with his life. And the king granting him the opportunity to go back and repair the walls. And when he was finished, then he, in the 8th verse of or chapter, you'll read it there. Then he comes up and he says, "Do not sorrow anymore, for the joy of the Lord is your strength." Now, listen. If the joy of the Lord is your strength, what is it then if you haven't got joy? It means that you are without strength. If that is your source, your main source of strength, joy, and it's so many times in the Bible, it means that we have chosen weakness instead of strength, because it's joy of the Lord that gives us strength. I go into the shopping places in the morning, and if I'm home, then my children now send me all over. I'm now the boy that must go and get the paper and the bread and the stuff. So I go into the shop, and when I get in there, the cashier says, "Morning." And then I say, "I'm sorry, was it a big funeral?" And she says, "What do you mean?" I said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. You were so sad that I thought it was a funeral, you know." And then the smile comes. As I love that smile, you know. Now, don't let me do it with you, okay? But it is, you know, I just want to share with you, and let me say to you that, let my testimony be to you just an encouragement to say that I have lived up till the age of, well, I couldn't count all the years, but for a number of years, practicing an artificial smile. I was never nasty and never rude. Every Afrikaner, I would put on a smile, you know. But it wasn't sincere. Until Jesus gave me joy. Now, I have 3 times more Afrikaner friends than I have, you know, people of color. I don't know what the Lord means by that. But one thing I do know is that the Lord wants us to live as people who have the peace and the joy in our heart, so that people can ask us, "What makes you happy?" And what an opening. What an opening. But if your face chases them away, you miss an opportunity to witness. I like it when somebody asks me a question, a sort of nice question, you know. "What are you doing, you know?" And in the plane, and I say, "You really want to know? You sure? This flight is 16 hours, you know, are you sure?" But we are to be that light, that there is hope, even in a hopeless world. Because our Christ is alive and He's well. And He means what He says, and He's everything that He says. I want to work for another few years, if I'm allowed to. And wherever I go, very seldom give testimony, but there's always a piece that go in there. But it's amazing, some of my colleagues and friends that we've worked with, that we not realize that how God has lit up something, not only for South Africa, but lit something up in their lives for where they are now outside. Speaking, of course, we need it here too now, but to really be a light out there to say there is hope. I really want you to pray for me when I leave on Friday. I leave on Friday, and when I got the program, I don't easily get cold. I got cold feet almost, and I felt, oh my. How am I going to do this in 6 to 7 days when they stated there are some 7 different departments of justice, of law, and of what all for short meetings, meeting with the president, meeting with the vice president, and addressing parliament? Do you think I'm not nervous? I am very, very nervous. But I know my God is who he says he is. I know he's everything that he says he is. And I'm just going to be as scared as I am when I get there. But once I get going, I just believe that the Holy Spirit will give me what I need for there. I didn't come here for this. I come here to preach. Or let me say my right English, I came here to preach. But I didn't. But I felt it right to do. Because I really feel that in the time that we live now, that we should not be robbed of what God intends for us. He has only the best in mind for us. And don't ever be your own enemy by losing your joy. But live in the strength that joy gives to you. Then God can use you. People want to be witness to people that are friendly, people that are joyous. I finish with my last story, not about the politics. I took a group of 175 young people to Namibia. And I end off with this, and it will... I saw the board on 10 minutes and I will be finished earlier than that, if you believe me. And we went to go and work for the Lord years ago. And I feel I must just bring this to end it off. 175 young people to go and work in Namibia. This is some 30 plus years ago. And when we got there, put up the tent in the one big town, and we had the flyers, the notices, invitations all out, and the evening, not one single person other than us came to the meetings. And we couldn't believe it. It's not true. It can't be. And after trying it the second day, people wouldn't greet us. They walked past. And as they walked past and they see us, they would turn their face. And we thought, yes, something happening in this town, Rehoboth. And we just can't do it. We just can't happen to break through. And what happened? I said to the young people, tomorrow we meet and we head for the desert. And we met into the Namibian desert, and we climbed into the desert, and there we went and cried before the Lord to reveal to us what is happening and what can we do. We came back from there feeling powerful. Something is going to happen. We decided that we're going to have the meeting tonight in the street, and the street is dusty streets that it was at the time. And the only place that we could use was where there was one massive lamppost was under a people's near to their fence, just in front of their door. So they had no escape. We had the meeting there and they begin to strike up with the music, and suddenly the owner of the house drove out with his car and he began to drive up and down in the road in the dust, so that we were coughing and clinging to, just our tongues, our everything, because we see ourselves in dust. And he did it about 6-7 times to stop us from doing that meeting. As he did it about the 7th time, he lost control of his car, swung into his own fence. But in front of the fence was standing his small 7-year-old boy. And he drove into that boy, into the fence. He realized what had happened, came down, knelt down there and cried. And the family came. I had a nurse with me on the team. They rushed to hospital. We didn't think the boy would live. Rushed him to hospital while we were dealing with a family, big family, coming to the Lord, because now what had happened? They felt the power of the Lord there, and they were going against what God was doing. I can tell you, the boy, miraculously, 3-4 days later, came home. He was okay. It was just something that God used. The next night, we couldn't put all the people in the tent that came. And revival broke out right there. A few of the team, and this is what I close with, a few of the team, young people, came with me as we go to the shop to go and get supplies. And as we came to the cashier with our supplies, the lady behind the cashier screamed. And she got up and her eyes grew and she just walked away and she said, "Go away, go away." And we said, no, we're just coming to pay. She said, no. And she screamed and everybody's watching. The owner came and she just pointed the owner to us. And we said, we just got our groceries. We just want to pay. And she says, "No, they're angels." And then I realized God had turned up. We found him in the desert, or he found us in the desert. And there was revival in the place as people came to the Lord. Just simple people that shone for Jesus, or shone for Jesus. And there's no better shining than a smile. No better shining than a smile. I want to end off by saying to you, you've listened to all my stories. Some you may have enjoyed, others not. But let me say to you, I'm here as a witness to say to you that Jesus is willing to take each one that is ready to be used of him in a miraculous way. And after 63 years of preaching this gospel, I know Jesus is everything that he says he is. And you can trust him. You can believe him. And you can also surrender to him so that he makes you everything that he actually planned for you. Some of you here tonight may not really know why you are here. I'm a Christian and I feel good and I love the Lord and I come to church and I study here or whatever. But you've got to find the reason why you are here. God has no casual hands on earth. We're all permanent staff. We're all permanent staff to be employed and to be deployed. What we need is strength of character and spiritual strength. And that comes through having the joy of the Lord in our lives, so that others may see that they're missing out on a joyful life that God intends for us. I wish you well on your journey. I wish you well in your life and pray that God may extract everything out of you that he has planned you here for, so that he may achieve through you and in you everything that he has in mind for you. God bless you. And I love you.
So,
remember that our sermons are also available on Shofar TV. Go to www.shofaronline.tv to download and share.